cultural offerings do we have? And Yacht Rock at State Farm Center, not so much. But it's a group from Atlanta and Orleans. Maybe that's a group from New Orleans. Okay, clubs that I don't even know of are listed there. I haven't been getting around too much. Church Street Ramblers tomorrow. I already gave sort of a disclaimer, and I already told you I don't have enough time to play everything I have. I've got something from Epstein, or something about Epstein. I'm replaying it from a month ago because I haven't heard anything more about the intelligence connections of Epstein and the widespread project he had, which was blackmailing some of the elites that came to his den of iniquity. Here's Amy Goodman on setbacks to Trump in the courts. I'm hoping that Judd Roberts will twist some arms and get not grant certification, a certiorari or whatever that's called, so they don't even hear the cases. That would be a convenient way for him to finesse making a big decision about some of these reversals that Trump has experienced. Maybe I'm dreaming.
Losing streak. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Donald Trump is on a losing streak this week. Just look at the latest judicial decisions challenging his policies, from mass deportations to tariffs to his troop deployments to U.S. cities. The courts are proving to be a significant check on Trump's thirst for absolute power. These cases illustrate the point. Immigration. Over Labor Day weekend, ICE attempted to begin deporting up to 700 unaccompanied Guatemalan children. In the dead of night, the first children were loaded onto planes in South Texas.
These are unaccompanied children who do not have a parent or a guardian with them.
Efren Olivares, an attorney representing the minors, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, at 1 a.m. on Sunday morning, Olivares and his colleagues filed an emergency complaint with the federal court in Washington, D.C. Judge Sparkle Suknanum was woken after 2 a.m., and by 4 a.m., she issued a temporary restraining order blocking the deportations until the children had the immigration hearings to which they have a legal right. Meanwhile, in Texas, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, considered the nation's most conservative, ruled that Trump's use of the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to deport people was illegal. Tariffs. The appeals court in Washington, D.C. ruled that Trump's so-called Liberation Day tariffs were illegal and unconstitutional, noting that only Congress has the power to impose tariffs. The ruling was...
It's a sweeping decision that, you know, unequivocally rebukes President Trump's idea that he can impose tariffs on American consumers on his own.
Neil Katyal, the attorney who argued the case, said on Democracy Now! Domestic deployment of the military. Trump says...
We're going in.
Threatening to invade Chicago, using, among other forces, the Texas National Guard. But in California, a federal judge, invoking the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act that bars the use of military and domestic law enforcement, ruled in favor of Governor Gavin Newsom, finding Trump's deployment of the California National Guard to the streets of Los Angeles, along with several hundred U.S. Marines, was illegal. Judge Charles Breyer, the brother of retired U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, issued an injunction barring the Trump administration from, quote, deploying, ordering, instructing, training, or using the National Guard currently deployed in California and any military troops from engaging in arrests, apprehensions, searches, seizures, security patrols, traffic control, crowd control, riot control, evidence collection, interrogation, or acting as informants, he said. These are just a few of the recent court cases that have rebuked Trump as he attempts to subvert the U.S. Constitution. We recently got a personal glimpse into what judicial wins over Trump look like. In the high mountain air of Telluride, Colorado, we had a chance to spend time with E. Jean Carroll, the renowned advice columnist and journalist. She was at the Telluride Film Festival for the premiere of the new documentary, Ask E. Jean. Carroll had a long and storied career as the advice columnist for Elle magazine and has published several books. In recent years, she became known as one of the most prominent women to accuse Donald Trump of sexual abuse, saying he raped her in the dressing room of the Bergdorf Goodman department store in the mid-1990s in Manhattan. Carol sued Trump in civil court, and a jury found him guilty of sexually abusing her. Judge Lewis Kaplan wrote, quote, Trump did in fact rape Ms. Carol, as that term commonly is used and understood, the judge said. Carol was awarded a $5 million settlement from Trump. After the verdict, he called her a liar. She then sued for defamation and won an additional jury award of $83.3 million. E. Jean Carroll cut an elegant figure, walking along Telluride's main avenue with the sweeping Continental Divide as a backdrop. Her film premiered to rave reviews, and should there remain a film distributor in this country not cowed by threats of lawsuits from Trump, it should be available for viewing by a wide audience. The film highlights the story of one courageous woman refusing to be defined as a victim of Donald Trump, providing inspiration, no doubt, to the hundreds of survivors of Trump's old friend, the now-dead sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein. Many of them spoke this week outside the U.S. Capitol demanding the full release of the Epstein files. The Trump administration, which controls the files, is resisting. Behind each lawsuit are impacted people, whether immigrant children pulled from their beds in the middle of the night and thrown on planes, or people standing up in the streets of L.A. confronting illegally deployed troops, whether sexual abuse survivors banding together or federal workers fired en masse. The courts are playing a central role in opposing the lawless Trump administration, but the core of the resistance are people. People at every level, organized in opposition, defending democracy. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Hope you enjoy it. We're joined now by Emily Bender, who's a professor of linguistics at the University of Washington. Alex Hanna, who's director of research at the Distributed AI Research Institute. Together, they have just co-authored the book, The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want. Thank you both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I think we should probably start with definitions, because when a technology enters the hype cycle, everyone who wants to raise a round of venture capital uses the same buzzword. It seems like the label AI is being applied to a lot of discrete technologies and applications right now. How are you defining it?
So the term AI is just a marketing term. We like to say that what AI actually means is venture capitalists, please give us some money. It doesn't refer to a coherent set of technologies. And for each technology it's applied to, it oversells what they can actually do. And so we recommend instead to have clearer conversations, naming the specific thing that's being built in terms of its functionality, or if you need a more general word, then automation serves just fine.
When we talk about artificial intelligence too, it becomes a word that can entail so many different things. So it can include things as basic as a set of spreadsheets, but then also gets applied to techniques which are quite old, like linear and logistic regression. And then that gets lumped into generative AI tools, such as large language models and diffusion models. So it's helpful to be as precise as possible as well, because it helps distinguish what the inputs are to a particular set of technologies and what the outputs are, and if those inputs can connect to those outputs in any kind of meaningful way.
So maybe if the framework we're approaching this from is the hype, we should start with the generative text technology based on large language models. I think AI entered popular currency when ChatGPT made its debut. Like, what is that technology actually doing?
Yeah, so it's important to recognize that ChatGPT felt like this breakthrough moment, but it wasn't actually that there was a big technological breakthrough. What happened was things had scaled to a certain point where the output text had a very convincing degree of fluency, and OpenAI very cleverly wrapped it up in an approachable demo, and then everyone got excited. But from the point of view of computational linguistics, it actually isn't all that new. Language modeling goes back to the 1940s, and what language modeling really is coming up with a statistical model of the distribution of word spellings in some collection of text. And this is familiar already from things like the predictive text on your cell phone, or even earlier than that, the text on nine keys entry system. And in all of those use cases, what we were doing was saying, okay, we've got a different set of strings this might have been. Could have been that word, could have been that word. Which one is more likely according to the training data? And what changes with the synthetic text extruding machines, what gets called large language models, is that instead of asking which of these sentences is more likely, we are repeatedly asking, what is a likely next word? And so we get plausible-looking synthetic text that is completely untethered from any communicative intent or accountability for what's in it.
And we anthropomorphize it.
We definitely anthropomorphize it, yes. And that plays on our ability to make sense of language, which is a really interesting thing. And here's where the linguistics really comes in. You might think that when you're understanding what someone is saying, what's happened is the speaker has had an idea, they've packed it into the words, send the words across to you, and then you unpack the idea from the words. That's actually not what's going on. What's going on is you are thinking, okay, what do I know about that person and what they believe about the world and what we have in common ground and what they believe about what I believe? And given all of that, what must they have meant to convey by choosing those words in that order? And what's key about that is that in order to do all that, we are imagining the mind behind the text. Perfectly fine when there is one, but with ChatGPT, there isn't.
So we're hallucinating when we imagine a mind behind the text.
I would wouldn't say it's exactly hallucinating, but we are reflexively applying the way we make sense of language. And it is very hard to take that one more step and say, oh, that was me doing what I have to do to make sense of the text, but there really wasn't somebody saying it. This is synthetic text. And that's hard to remember to do, but it's really important.
So would you say, like, if your framework for understanding AI is the defining and unifying characteristic of what's being called AI now is the fact that it's being hyped, the innovation is presenting it as something that lets us imagine a mind behind it, kind of playing to 50 years of sci-fi narrative tropes?
I mean, I don't think that's necessarily the innovation here. I mean, there's a few, you know, if we were going to present what the innovations are, there are a few technical innovations. I mean, one of them is the development of a specific type of model architecture called the transformer model. And so that had taken effectively a means to take larger inputs and then output larger outputs. So kind of prior to the current era, the amount of training data that could be fed into these particular models was quite a bit smaller. With the transformer architecture, it allows much more training data to be fed continuously into these large neural network architectures. And so that is a technical innovation, but it is one that is interestingly not as impressive as the AI boosters will like to have you believe it is, because the fundamental basics of the architecture don't change that much, but the amount of data that they scrape from everywhere is orders of magnitude larger than it had been before.
I would actually say that more strongly, that no matter how big it gets, these output strings that add up to something false, so a non-existent citation or a misleading claim, are just an inherent property of using synthetic text as if it could answer questions or write papers or something. But what more and more text does do, because we are to scales now, we've been to this scale since at least 2020, that the data cannot be collected carefully. The larger your data set, the more likely you are to get just absolute trash in it and patterns in text that are going to include completely repulsive outputs. And OpenAI has put in they haven't put in the work. They have caused a lot of people under very exploitative conditions to do a lot of work to clean that up. And it's still not perfect, but it masks a little bit how awful it is.
Repulsive outputs. We have the great fortune to have scheduled this interview the week that Elon Musk's AI started spewing anti-Semitic vitriol and declared itself Mecha Hitler before being briefly shut down to fix whatever circuit blew.
Yeah, I mean, we had a prior iteration of that, right, with the white genocide thing that Grok had been outputting a few weeks ago, and this whole thing about kill the Boers and this whole South African white supremacist nonsense.
And going back almost 10 years, in 2016, Microsoft briefly had a chatbot called Tay that was meant to, in quotes, learn from its interlocutors on Twitter, and people got a hold of it and turned it into, you know, the most bigoted, awful thing in 24 hours, and it was taken down.
So I fully understand this critique for the reasons you've outlined. I don't rely on generative AI for any of my writing and hate that it gets shoehorned into my search results. But I'm also mindful that, like, a lot of human-generated communication is not very careful about or concerned with facts either. Are we maybe establishing a false binary here?
So there's an enormous difference which has to do with accountability. If a person has said something, they have accountability for it. If this is just synthetic text coming out of the synthetic text extruding machine that OpenAI has, and others, Gemini is the same, right, has set up as a spigot that someone can turn on, you lack that accountability. And the accountability is both important for, like, if something is misleading, then someone has responsibility, but also for how we interpret things. If you go to one of these answer machines and ask it a question and get back something that looks like an answer, and you take that as an okay way to access information, you are buying into a view of the world that doesn't actually make much sense, that there are sort of just answers out there in the world that are available to you, and that every question has an answer, and then that's a fine way to go about it, rather than understanding how your question relates to the information landscape and how different sources of information relate to each other.
Yeah, I would also say that understanding the source of a particular speaker also allows you to make some assessments of the source as a particular, whether it's an understanding of a particular bias or viewpoint. And even if someone doesn't care about the truth values of their statements, you actually know that about them as a pattern. There's this Harry Frankfurt's concept of bull, and the idea that, you know, the bull does not really care about the veracity of their claims. They're trying to instrumentalize their language.
Meaning they're speaking to manipulate. They don't care whether it's true or false. And his contrast is to a liar, which is someone who knows what the truth is and that they're not using it. The bull doesn't care in the first place.
That's right. And so in this case, we know that, you know, Trump is the bull their par excellence, right? There is an instrumental, you know, feature of his speech. And, you know, many people, even those who agree with him, you know, recognize such a thing.
They're eating the cats, they're eating the dogs.
Yeah, yeah. And so to that end, there is some kind of way that you can make reference to who the speaker is and what they're doing and what their motivations are.
In other words, the fact that it's a human, the human has motives, they want to accomplish something functionally with their words. That gives you a reference point for the language, even though the language itself doesn't have factual reality as a reference point.
Right. And it helps us situate what's happening with the language and understand, okay, is this likely to be someone bullshitting? Is it likely to be someone who's speaking in earnest, but not actually well positioned to know what they're talking about and so on?
Hmm. Thank you for this tour under the hood of the generative text engines that have captured our imagination and worsened our internet over the course of the past 2.5 years. A lot of people have fun with these. They have conversations with them. They use them to accomplish really treacherous tasks like writing cover letters, language we have to output that no one ever necessarily reads in their lives. What do you see as the downside of having generative text engines like this out in the wild?
There's quite a few downsides. I guess I would start with the environmental ones. These things are environmentally disastrous, and we are getting a push to bigger and bigger ones. All these hyperscale data centers are being built, having enormous impacts on our ability to decarbonize. So coal-fired power plants that were meant to be sunsetted are still online to support the electricity needs. There is a massive impact on fresh, clean drinking water supply in the communities that these things go into. And it's not that any individual query to one of these systems is itself environmentally disastrous, but the more it's a normalized practice, the more we are supporting the companies drive to make bigger and bigger models like this and bigger data centers.
The second part of it is the reliance on data that's taken without consent, specifically written works by artists, journalists, novelists, whomever. So that's a major issue and one that is winding its way through courts. And I guess, you know, there's also the labor component of it. There's an idea that these things can do those jobs that seem like drudgery correctly and efficiently. But that is turning out not to be the case. We're seeing many cases in which companies that thought they could do with less employees are actually then rehiring those employees, either at a piecemeal rate or outsourcing that labor to business process outsourcing organizations. So we've seen this in a few cases. I think Klarna had been one, which is the fintech corporation that seems to have reinvented layaway. And so they have rehired a bunch of people back. But we've seen this in other fields as well. I would also say that and this is some kind of an externality that we didn't really anticipate in the book, but we're seeing more and more. I think the more people are interacting with these tools, the more we're seeing a lot of really horrific mental health effects. I would say that, you know, a colleague of ours said that she was getting some of these emails almost daily now. At DARE, we get a few of these emails a week of people who have started talking with or having simulated conversations with these tools and have gone down some really dark rabbit holes, think that the machine has become conscious or they have discovered God or done something really absurd. And there was some great reporting at Futurism, which had reported many people that had not reported any kind of history of kind of mental health issues had been driven to really bizarre mental health situations due to these tools. So, you know, there's maybe some innocence in initiating these conversations, but some really weirdness happening on the back end of them.
But, I mean, people have gone to dark places being alone with their thoughts in other contexts, you know, with a strong dose of psychedelics or a bad or malicious therapist. I mean, is what you're describing new or just an old problem that is newly happening through the tool of AI chatbots?
I mean, I don't think psychedelics and badly motivated therapists are as widely available and offered by a corporation at this scale.
And they're also not gone, right? So it's not like this replaced those things. It's created a new opportunity. And it's possible that some of the people who are having these bad experiences would have had them in some other way. But I think they're taking on a different shape. And I think, again, I'm not a psychologist, but if you have fallen into the illusion that you are talking to a thinking entity, and that entity is designed through this process that they call reinforcement learning from human feedback to be agreeable and reinforce what you're saying, that can be, I think, quite dangerous.
Right, because it becomes a spiral instead of a recalibration between what's going on in your head and what's happening in the social world.
Infuriatingly, there are plenty of people who are marketing these things as a psychotherapy replacement, which is just awful, right? Because psychotherapy is not just a conversation, right? That involves someone who is highly trained, who has a lot of understanding about what might be going on inside of a person and how to react in different ways and how to challenge when need be. And that's not what's happening with these machines. It never could be. Like, it's also about empathy and connection. And these machines can simulate that. They can make it seem like you are experiencing something empathetic. And we hear stories of people who say, I don't want to talk to anybody else now because nobody else will just let me be me. Right? And the thing about real friends is that they are people who have needs that you have to interact with. And that's how we're meant to exist, is in community with other people.
Yeah. I mean, I would also say that there's a major problem here, again, when it comes to accountability. There are at least two cases in which there are people who have taken their own lives after interacting with chatbots. One was a Belgian man that was reported in a publication called La Libre. There was another young person who died by suicide after speaking with Character.ai, and the family brought suit against Character.ai. Character.ai is now using a free speech defense for their tool. So this gets into the kind of role of platforms and accountability. You'd imagine that a, you know, misaligned therapist would be at least someone that is held to professional standards.
So Alex, I want to dig into something you made reference to earlier, which is kind of the labor problem posed by AI. Because it seems to me there are two contradictory claims in your critique. One is that it threatens jobs, and the other is that it doesn't work at replacing humans. One's true, the other isn't a real problem, or not for long.
Yeah, the apparent contradictory claim is it can replace humans and it doesn't work, but they're not contradictory when you clarify the claim that says they threaten to replace work, and the idea that it can replace work adequately is enough to get rid of positions. And so it's not that these things work well, is that they appear to work well. And then when you actually get into it and actually get into particular tasks, they actually work quite poor and require a lot of human supervision. And so that human supervision either comes at the front end at kind of tweaking training data and ensuring that a model does what the intended output of the system is, or the human output. And this is kind of that. So the former part is what we call like data labor or data work, or the labor happens on the back end of the model outputs and it's fixing the outputs. And this is what we call labor displacement. And so the responsibility of workers, the workers that are left, is to fix all the nonsense that is coming out of these machines and try to make them workable. It adds work to a smaller set of workers who are involved in this.
Is that a problem with the technology sucking or with bosses sucking?
It's a problem with hype. Right? Technology sucks, bosses suck, but the hype tells the bosses that this technology is good.
Yeah, I mean, it's both, right? I mean, it's insofar as the technology sucks and it is not going to get to a place where it doesn't suck. And it's the case that bosses suck because they're always trying to supplant wages. And so to that degree, I mean, AI in its current iteration is fundamentally a type of bossware. It's a way of trying to, you know, reduce wages in particular industries, but doing that in ways which are not actually going to do this to any kind of, you know, any kind of real effect. And so you can hold both of those at the same time.
That's the voice of Alex Hanna, Director of Research at the Distributed AI Research Institute, or DARE. Also with us, Emily Bender, Professor of Linguistics at the University of Washington. The two of them have just co-authored the book, The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want.
Which has been about...
Okay, I didn't warn you that that's what was we were going to nerd out a bit, but I like that expression, bossware. AI, the AI con, and we have a nuclear deal with Meta extending the life of the reactor at Clinton for, I don't know how many decades, a couple, beyond its construction permit limit, which a lot of the renewals have happened. I'm beating that drum because I have an article about the small modular reactor that the U of I has signed a contract to build on campus right next to the railroad tracks. It's very frustrating. People might have tuned in the beginning. We had some jackhammers going on in the next building. I talked to the workman, and he's going to use a hammer and chisel. But that doesn't sound right either. I'm going to go tell him. I've got a long segment here. Another a bit of a nerdy subject, letters in politics. Anyway, we'll get right to that. Also from KPFA Pacifica. I'm going to tell the guy he can work for the next half hour. Very end, I'm going to replay something that I played a month ago about Epstein, so hang around for that. Sam Husseini talking about what's not being spoken, the allegations widespread of, at least in some areas, of intelligence connections that Epstein had, why he was untouchable, according to Acosta, that gave him the easy deal in Florida when he was first charged.
About 4 weeks since President Donald Trump nationalized Washington, D.C.'s Metropolitan Police Force and ordered National Guard troops to the streets in the city, President Trump on Wednesday also said he would like to send the National Guard to Chicago next, but that will be tougher to achieve as the president doesn't have the same kind of legal authority over states as he does the nation's capital. Earlier this week, a federal judge here on the West Coast ruled that the previous deployment of National Guard troops to Los Angeles ended up violating what is known as the Posse Comitatus Act. Today, we go to Washington, D.C., where I'm very happy to welcome back to this radio program historian and political scientist Clarence Lusain for a conversation about this current moment that we are experiencing nationally and in Washington, D.C., and to try to put it in its historical context. Clarence Lusain is a professor of political science at Howard University. He's the author of many books, including $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman, and the ongoing fight for racial justice and democracy. Professor Lusain, it is a good pleasure, sir, to see you again. I see you over video chat. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad to be back.
Talk to me. What is it like, and what has it been like in Washington, D.C. this past month?
It's been gruesome. So the city feels very much occupied. You know, I spent a lot of time in countries around the world that are fighting for democracy. And it feels very much like circumstances where the military has moved in, people's movements are restricted, and there's kind of an overriding sense of containment of people's rights. The National Guard and the DC police, which have basically been taken over, are all over the city. They're not just in the more populated tourist areas, which had been sort of the sense that people felt, but they're in all of the different quadrants. And it's a combination of the National Guard, the DC police, and ICE. So very much our Latino communities, DC has a large immigrant community beyond the Latinos, are all feeling under siege. And so its impact has been, events have been canceled, particularly outdoor events. There's a big concern because there are a number of public schools, elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools that have disproportionate students that are from immigrant backgrounds. And so there's been a kind of watching and committees have formed, often spontaneous, that are there in the morning when schools open and children arrive, and that are there in the evening or in the afternoon when schools let out. And a number of people who live near those schools have set up basically safe houses. So if the kids need to go to somebody's house, for example, they have the ability to do that. There are protests literally every day, almost by the hour. And when ICE kind of shows up, people come out and they bang on pots and, you know, make a lot of noise. They introduce themselves to the National Guard, you know, because they're changing them around. So it's really affected the quality of life in the city. And there's, you know, a big concern, there are a number of concerns, but one is that the city leadership has essentially capitulated. And rather than stand up in the way in which we saw, for example, Mayor Karen Bass in Los Angeles and call out the authoritarianism, we find these euphemisms coming from the mayor and others that basically accommodate and appease the Trump administration. And, you know, all of history tells us that appeasement does not work at all. It only makes authoritarians and fascists even more aggressive.
What's the relationship of the federal government to Washington, D.C.? As I said in the introduction yesterday, Donald Trump sort of just talked about sending the National Guard to Chicago next. That it seems like that would be legally much more difficult to do than what has happened in Washington, D.C. I'm in Oakland, California. Donald Trump has talked about sending the National Guard here. That would be one hell of a show if that were to happen in Oakland. But D.C. is different. Tell me about that relationship of D.C. to the federal government.
So Washington, D.C., historically, from its construction in 1800 up to the very present, has basically been under the thumb of the federal government. D.C. was built as an enclave from land donated by Virginia and Maryland that would service the federal government, Congress, and the White House. And so what that had meant was that D.C., up until the 1970s, never had an independent government. It was always appointed mayors, appointed councils along the way. In the 1970s, legislation was passed that gave D.C. what's called home rule, which is a degree of autonomy. D.C. has an elected mayor, has an elected city council, and a school board. But every single law passed in the city has to be approved by Congress. Every tax initiative has to be approved by Congress. Congress can literally overthrow legislation that's passed by Washington, D.C. And increasingly from the 1950s up through the most recent period, as the city became majority Black and majority progressive and majority Democratic, that meant that for the Republican side of the aisle, there was no giving of independence and self-determination for the city. It also meant that for many conservative Democrats. So the Dixiecrats, for example, who pretty much held sway in Congress up until the 70s, into the 80s, were just as awful towards D.C. as were the Republicans. And so Donald Trump was basically able to exploit the law that permits the federal government, either Congress or the U.S., or the White House, to impose policies and behavior that they absolutely cannot do anywhere else in the country.
I lived in Washington, D.C. for a number of years, about 20 years ago. And some things stood out to me immediately. One, I remember seeing, you know, bumper stickers on cars, taxation without representation. Right? I'm like, what's that about? I think more people now know about D.C.'s status. But, you know, back then, not as many people. And I didn't know when I first got there. And I was like, oh, they have very limited self-rule. And then I also remember, as you indicated, that D.C. is its population is a majority of people of color. When I lived there, I still think it was 60% African American. Right. I know gentrification has happened since then. But what I realized with a Republican controlled Congress, they were able to implement their ideal, what they wanted, right, on DC,
right.
Even though they couldn't get it through the rest of the country.
So gun laws, laws around medical marijuana, pretty much kind of across the board, DC has had to bow to the whims of Congress. And I would also underscore that also like on every other area in the country, there is no representation in the Senate for Washington, D.C. And in the House of Representatives, we have what's called a delegate, which is a non-voting member of Congress who's allowed to sit on committees, but does not have the capital that every other member of the House has, which is their vote. For about 5 years, I actually worked for the person who was the previous representative to D.C., and so, you know, we fought around these issues all the time. So, I have a good sense, and it's actually just gotten worse rather than better.
Is this federalizing of the DC? How is the DC police department responding to this federalization of itself?
So there was some initial pushback from the police chief, but I think the mayor pretty much pulled her coat and said, you can't really do that. And so the mayor issued an executive order the other day that essentially says we have a partnership between the DC government and DC police with the federalization. And it's not a partnership, it's a takeover. And it's extremely painful, I think, for DC citizens to see this kind of, as I mentioned earlier, capitulation, where you're seeing resistance coming from Pritzker, from Karen Bass, from a number, from Governor Newsom, from a number of figures who say that, correctly, that we're fighting authoritarianism. And that means that you've got to stand up and resist. Now, DC is in a precarious situation. About $1 billion, it probably at least, has been cut from the city budget. DC gets an annual federal allocation. And it's not, DC makes requests, but ultimately it's decided by the members of Congress. So there's a lot of hurt and pain that can be brought to the city. And there are people in Congress and certainly in the White House that would be more than willing to do that. But it doesn't get by the fact that the rights of people in the city, just like across the country, are being violated. And you have to speak up on behalf of those rights.
Part of what's happening is the dismantling of homeless encampments. What is happening to the people who are at these camps? Are there any support services? Are they just like...
So we're not sure because there's been a few dozen just the other day of these camps, or at least as they see them as camps. They have been dismantled. They literally kind of come in and scatter people, sometimes take people away. The other day, for example, one of our big city institutions is a public library downtown, Martin Luther King. And it's in an area where there's a lot of space in front of the library. And there had been homeless people there. The soldiers came in the other day. They chased everybody away. They brought in garbage trucks. Everything that was left was thrown into the garbage, those garbage, big giant garbage trucks, and they cleared the area out. But it's not clear at all where people are going, including people who have been taken away. But it's disruptive. And of course, it's created significant degree of disruption in neighborhoods and areas. There's been long efforts to try to address the unhoused population. And to find, make sure there's shelters and, other accommodations. But this certainly is not the way to kind of do it, which is from the Trump administration. We're going to be as brutal and as blunt as we can be, and we don't care what kind of pain and distress people are under.
Washington, D.C., like most big cities in this country, a lot of people come just outside of Washington, D.C., into D.C. for work and official business. A lot of people come from Maryland and Virginia. My understanding is right now not everyone is coming because they are scared, particularly because of the presence of ICE.
So there are a couple of factors. One, it certainly has been a documented downturn in people coming to the city. People are choosing to work at home, for example, when they would normally kind of come to the city. People are not coming to restaurants. They're not coming to events. Some of the people are disgusted by, people not coming to, the Kennedy Center since Trump took it over, for example. But the other factor is that there's a significant number of the population that work for the federal government that have lost jobs. People who have worked at USAID, who worked at the State Department, Department of Labor, Department of Education, and so forth. People who had jobs in January who do not have jobs now, who have just simply been let go. And so that's created another stress for the area. I've spent maybe 30 years working with the State Department. I've done traveled as part of the State Department soft power programs, and I've spoken in Pakistan and places. I've worked with projects in Brazil as part of the State Department. I've worked with international visitors that come. All of that's changed. And at this point, I know a few dozen people personally who have left the State Department. Some who were just kind of cut because they ended programs, others who simply could not stand another hour, minute, second under Marco Rubio. And so, but people have jobs, they have mortgages, they have kids in schools, so it's not an easy decision. And certainly not one that people who did not necessarily want to leave or, did not have another job lined up. So that's also kind of affected the area. And then on top of that is then you federalize the National Guard and you create an environment that is wholly unwelcoming, both to people who would visit, but also to the people who are here already.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Clarence Lussain, professor of political science at Howard University, author of many books, including $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman, and The Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. We do want to invite our listeners to join this conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. We ask that you keep your comment or question to about a minute or so and keep it respectful. Again, that phone number is 1-800-958-9008. Clarence Lussain, you are a well-respected political scientist. As a political scientist, how do you see this moment? What's going on right now?
So I think we're living through what I call the chaos of authoritarian construction and consolidation. And by that, I mean that authoritarianism and fascism do not happen in one event or one policy. It evolves over time. That space between the destruction of liberal democracy and implementation is a chaotic period because no one wants to give up their rights. No one wants to have troops in their face. And so you have these authoritarian movements that sometimes come to power electorally, but then very rapidly begin to dismantle these levers of democracy. And what we've seen, I think, here in the U.S., which I would date back to the 70s, a political party that increasingly moved further and further to the right, from the Southern Strategy implemented by Richard Nixon, where there was a decision to bring disaffected whites in the South into the Republican Party that had been rejected for decades because of Abraham Lincoln, to Ronald Reagan, who comes in, who articulates a more softer version of white nationalism, but it's fairly clear in addition to the attacks on working people. And for example, Controllers Union that was crushed, PACO is the name of the union, that was a message to unionism. And from that period to now, there's been a steady erosion of union support and union participation. That all happens in an era of deindustrialization, which transforms this country fundamentally. The period from the 30s up through the 60s, early 70s with industrial growth, which meant that people across the country, but particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest, built entire cities and communities from the benefits of industrialization, which was also integrated. And for many African Americans who had come up from the South, many people who had less than high school education, many people who had come out of the military, out of Vietnam War, people who had come out of incarceration, were able to find work that paid a living wage and to build families so their children could go to college, their children could get a job. All of that comes crashing down when we get to the mid to late 70s with the deindustrialization that happened. But that also feeds a conservative politics, all of which we see rise up again and again. We see it with the Newt Gingrich, the contract with American Republicans. We saw it with the backlash against Obama with the Tea Party. So Donald Trump comes, he's the result of all of that. he doesn't come out of fall from the sky, but he's the culmination of the increasing far right politics of the Republican Party. And where they're at now, and certainly with Donald Trump, is the goal is to create an imperial presidency and a one-party state. Stephen Miller, all of the ideologues of the Trump administration have said again and again that the Democratic Party is an illegitimate, they've even called it a terrorist organization, but the real goal is that they want one-party rule, and that party would rule with a far-right theocratic frame for the country that would reverse essentially the gains of the 20th century.
Do you see that playing out right now in what's being dubbed as a redistricting war?
Oh, absolutely. So part of the authoritarian playbook is what do you do with elections? And so while fascism simply abolishes elections altogether, under authoritarian states, increasing elections become more and more undemocratic, increasingly not accessible by the majority of people, and then they become rigged. And so for Donald Trump to say, I expect and I deserve more seats in Congress is a classic authoritarian move. And it's all of this is testing the waters of how far can they go. If they can do this in Texas and get away with it, why not do it in every single state that the Republicans control?
Right. So, they started doing it this week in Missouri.
They're doing it in Missouri.
I think California is doing it or will attempt to do it. Maryland may attempt to do it.
The problem, especially in some of these Republican states, is that they have already gerrymandered as maximum as they could. It's not like this is a new idea. They just thought of it in 2025. So they've been doing it, you know, for a few decades. So there's not a lot of space to redistrict themselves into, you know, another 400 seats or another, you know, 50 seats or anything. But that doesn't mean they're not going to try. And more importantly, I think it's the principle that we can shape the elections any way we want, regardless of the Voting Rights Act, regardless of what the Constitution says, regardless of what state law has said. And that's what I think we really have to kind of focus on. It's not just this particular case, but, you know, this is an attack on elections and democratic participation.
What do you think the natural outcome to all of this is, and do you see a force stopping it?
So I try to think about what set of events would have to happen in order to have Trump and MAGA out of power and for the country to move in a more progressive direction. And so that means it's not just one protest or one election. It means we need a long-term mass mobilizing strategy that institutionalizes democracies in ways that don't exist now and have not existed that have allowed for the far right to move forward. So a lot of what Donald Trump is doing is illegal, of course. And the courts, some of the courts are calling that out. They may be reversed at the Supreme Court, but they clearly are illegal. But a lot of what Donald Trump is doing is legal because there are loopholes in federal law and in the Constitution itself. And so that raises, you know, a question of, as we think about moving forward, it really means closing and rewriting the government in ways that it really does have a democratic constitution. So for example, pardon power. Donald Trump can pardon and has pardoned all kinds of criminals, including the 1,500 people that are part of the January 6th insurrection. That was legal under the U.S. Constitution. And the Supreme Court has said, you know, Trump has immunity pretty much for anything he does. So he can literally ask people to commit federal crimes because he can pardon them the second that they're charged. That requires, at this point, a constitutional amendment to be gotten rid of. The way Supreme Court justices are selected, the structure of the U.S. Senate, as you pointed out, the way congressional districts and state districts are drawn, all of that at this point are legal loopholes that are opportunities for a far-right agenda. So as we think ahead and think about what will be the steps to move these people out of power, it also has to include, you know, from my perspective, a really deep understanding of we cannot go back to 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, because those conditions set the stage for where we're at right now.
A lot of people are wondering about Donald Trump's health right now, and most of it is just speculation, and I don't want to speculate about his health, but how much do you think this is dependent on a single person, Donald Trump, what's happening? Does this movement have, and you never know until you see what ends up happening, but do you think this potentially ends when Donald Trump goes away one way or another?
So that's a great question, because much of what we see is cult of personality. And, you know, there's lots of survey and data showing that Many, many of the MAGA folks are aligned with Trump, not necessarily the Republican Party. So Trump has a big shadow over this movement, but Trump is mortal. And, you know, I wouldn't bet, you know, a nickel on, you know, Trump's health at all. The ability of him to continue, you know, certainly questionable. However, what they're doing is institutionalizing their far right agenda. Project 2025 was not as much about policy as much as reorganizing the entire government. And many of the far right theorists have long said, it kind of doesn't matter who is in the White House. If we can put in place the systems of governing that we want, then it won't matter that much. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
There is a conscious effort right now underway recognizing Donald Trump is mortal. Absolutely. Conscious effort to shape the system now that would allow the far right to continue to rule.
And at this point, J.D. Vance, who's certainly the vice president, would take over if Donald Trump is gone before the end of his presidency, but is positioning to be the 2028 candidate, represents a wing of the U.S. Ruling class that is probably more fascist than the other wings. Many of these new tech entrepreneurs, folks who are out your way, Peter Thiel and the rest of them, if you kind of go through their writings and their speeches, they are absolutely on the far right and have advocated everything from taking the vote away from people to eliminating taxes. You know, they have an agenda that is really kind of draconian. And so, you know, Trump is a unique historic figure with a outsized impact on the U.S. and the world. But it's not just about Trump by any stretch.
In case, and there are.
Okay, that was Clarence Hussein on the program Letters in Politics with Mitch Jezerich. His latest book is about the woman that's supposed to be on the $20 bill, whose name I can't remember. Or was it Fannie Lou Hamer? He's inside the Beltway, speculating there on the future without Trump. Indeed. I'm going to keep going. We solved the noise problem. The workman next door was quite okay to deal with. He's going to do the loud jackhammer work after 1 o'clock, so Radio Free Labor will be coming to you loud and clear. Here's a segment I promised you about at the top of the hour, if you heard. Dennis Bernstein, another go-to guy from Flashpoints, with Sam Husseini, talking about Jeffrey Epstein and his connections to intelligence that is not being discussed much in all the I'm glad the victims have been getting together and they're going to make their own dossier on who they were being forced to service, quote unquote. Yeah, here's an aspect that needs to be revisited.
There are two aspects that are critical to understand about Jeffrey Epstein. One is that he has multiple ties to Israel. And two is that there's substantial evidence that he was involved in not just pedophilia, but in blackmail. That is, the point of much of his enterprise seems not to have been simply abuse underage females, but to get footage of prominent, powerful people doing that in order to use that as blackmail over them. There's substantial evidence, and has been for some time, to that effect, but there's very little discussion about that in the mainstream discussion. And certainly, the parties have now flipped position on this, right? Like a year ago, it was Republicans saying, release the Epstein file, release the Epstein file, release the Epstein files. And of course, Biden wasn't going to do that. Additional footnote, the judge who it was recently reported that the judge who sealed much of the Epstein files, herself, her husband is a major partner at a law firm that is connected to virtually every bank that Jeffrey Epstein was associated with in his financial dealings. Bear Stearns, where he got his start, and J.P. Morgan, that last year had to do a huge payout over his scandals, and that she got a sweetheart deal on a penthouse in dealing with one of the bigwigs at Bear Stearns. So that's another aspect of this cover-up. But the two parties are playing this, what seems like an oppositional role, but is actually a symbiotic role. That is, the Republicans had been saying, release the Epstein files, and the Democrats weren't doing so, Biden and company. And now, with Trump in office, it's the Democrats screaming, release the Epstein files, and Trump not doing so. Now, Trump is paying something of a political price for that, because a bunch of his mega base is upset over this, and Tucker Carlson and Josh Rogan and whoever else are upset about this. But what are they going to do, vote Democrat? No. You know, that's how the system works. Politicians break their promises, and Trump is obviously happy to break this promise. And there are other aspects to this. For example, the Democrats, when they talk about release the Epstein files, you've had several of them, most prominently Hakeem Jeffries, one of the main Democratic leaders in Congress, say, why is Trump covering up? You know, Trump is clearly covering up for his billionaire cronies. But he doesn't name them. And we can name them. We don't have to wait for the Epstein's files to be released. It's been clear for several years who among some of these billionaires are. Les Wexner is clearly at the top of the list. He was CEO for Victoria's Secret. Victoria's Secret is a billionaire. He owns a huge chunk of Columbus, Ohio. He gave Epstein his residence in Manhattan, reportedly the largest private residence in Manhattan, a huge townhouse that was reportedly wired to the max, that it had like a room with, you know, surveillance cameras throughout the house, ideal for setting up a blackmail ring, that is, to capture people in illicit positions, illicit situations that you can then use to blackmail them. There's no good reason why someone like Hakeem Jeffries should be going on about how Trump is colluding with his billionaire buddies over Epstein to not name who they are. And Les Wexner is a very, very prominent supporter of Israel. He founded what was called the Mega Group with the Bronfmans of the Seagram's liquor empire, and has raised billions for all and many things Israel-related, from APEC to a whole, you know, list of other things. He's also, I mean, there are all kinds of familial ties as well. His brother, his father-in-law is Yehud Koppel, who's an Israeli military veteran with ties to Israeli intelligence. He's credited with helping found Israel through his role of the atrocity-checkered Haganah militia.
This is Les Wexner, right? We're talking about Les Wexner now, the founder of L Brands and all kinds of other stuff. Yes, go on.
Right.
Well, we should mention Hakeem Jeffries. Does Hakeem Jeffries receive a lot of money from Israeli lobbyists?
I don't have that at my fingertips. That would certainly be my, my presumption. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit more about what's going on here.
Yeah, so you have Epstein, who has multiple ties to Israel, and this whole, everybody's talking about Epstein and somehow managing to not talk about Israel. Another major aspect to this is the Maxwells. Now, his partner in crime, Ghislaine Maxwell, has been in prison for the last several years following his alleged suicide. Epstein's brother hired a pathologist who says that it wasn't a suicide, who says that he was killed while in federal custody in New York. And there are a whole series of scandals over that. The videotape, you know, allegedly malfunctioned, so they don't have actual footage of what happened. He was given all kinds of items which would assist in a suicide or murder, and so on. But Ghislaine Maxwell, her father is Robert Maxwell, who was outed as an Israeli super spy in 1991 by Seymour Hersh in his book, The Samson Option, about Israel's nuclear weapons capacity. He died mysteriously about a week after that book was released. So he's outed as an Israeli super spy, and he's killed on his, or he dies mysteriously on his yacht a week after that.
Donald Trump's losing streak. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Donald Trump is on a losing streak this week. Just look at the latest judicial decisions challenging his policies.
We were just talking about that, and that's why I didn't get it together in time. So we're going to hear a bit of Amy with Aaron Glantz on an issue I haven't heard discussed elsewhere. It's a web exclusive. I'm inclined to put on these web exclusive. So let's do that right now.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, September 3rd, is the last day for public comment on a newly proposed rule for the Department of Veterans Affairs. The draft regulation would ban VA doctors from performing most abortions. We're joined now by Guardian investigative reporter Aaron Glantz, who has a recent piece headlined New Trump Rule to Ban VA Abortions for Veterans, Even in Cases of Rape and Incest. This is the vice chair of Texas Democratic Veterans, Melissa Harcrow, speaking to KVUE-TV.
If they can't access contraceptives or abortion services in case they are sexually assaulted again, this can pose a barrier to them improving their quality of life. It's very upsetting because, I wonder, are they going to reduce access to Viagra for male veterans?
So, Aaron Glantz, you wrote this piece for The Guardian about what is being proposed right now. Explain what it is and why it's so important for the Department of Veterans Affairs to provide access to abortion.
Well, what the VA is doing here is saying that they will, going forward, if this is adopted, not provide abortion services, including not only procedures, but also counseling and prescription medication, even in cases of rape or incest. And this is an important thing to know about the veteran population is that there's a very high rate of sexual assault, both in the military itself and in the veteran population. So according to VA surveys, 1 in 3 female veterans was sexually assaulted in the service. The rate of intimate partner violence for female veterans is also well higher than people who never served in the military. And so basically what the Trump administration is saying here is that if you get pregnant in one of these ways, and then they will not help you terminate your pregnancy.
You did write to the press secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. What was their response?
They pointed out correctly that the VA has actually not been providing abortion services for that long. They only began providing abortion services in a very limited fashion in 2022. Under President Biden. Of course, this was after the Dobbs decision made abortion unavailable in most cases in many U.S. states, including Texas, Florida, Georgia, and other states with large and growing populations of female veterans. The VA also cited a 1992 law, which they say bans the agency from carrying out abortions. But that same law, a legal expert said it's been superseded, and the VA provides a lot of services that are not allowed under that law, for example, maternity care and IVF even. And so, the legal experts that I talked to said that that was a bit of a red herring. Finally, the VA said that because they're providing so few abortions at the agency, that they have a safety concern. And the female veterans that I spoke to for this story were, I cannot communicate to you how really deeply upset they were about what they see as fighting for freedom when they're in uniform, only to have their own freedoms taken away, their freedom to choose what they do with their own body when they get out.
Aaron, Trump's VA Secretary Doug Collins is a staunch abortion opponent. As a congressman, he received an A-plus rating from the Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America and established the right to abortion as barely coherent. Can you talk about his stance?
I mean, Secretary Collins was a former congressman.
Okay, that was a web exclusive. I hadn't planned on playing it, and obviously I didn't get it at all. You can find that at the Democracy Now! On web exclusive. Aaron Glantz was interviewed on another issue. He, by the way, was around the Independent Media Center not long ago. Well, maybe it was pretty long ago. Oh, we got the crew for Radio Free Labor. And one more announcement here. Toast to Taylor Street. Programming at WEFT is made possible in part by that Block Party series, celebrating life, culture, and business and music in downtown Champaign. final toast for Taylor Street is Saturday, September 13th, next week. Updates can be found at toasttotaylorstreet.com. WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio, where the opinions you hear are those of the speakers. Thanks for supporting community media, more important than ever.